Okay, testing. Yeah, we're on. All right. A couple months ago, I was started a talk on exoplanets. You all remember that? Most of you there. You should have got a handout that Valerie gave you one.
Okay. I remember that.
Okay, good. So we're going to continue. I'm going to back up a couple slides here, but why talk about exoplanets? Do we have any directive from God to look at things like that? Is it necessary? Is it important? A lot of people are looking. There's a lot of money being expended by the various governments. Well, it is part of God's creation, isn't it? Other planets. And everybody here, you all realize that there are other planets out there now, besides the ones in our solar system. We know for a fact that there are, we've detected thousands already. 2,000 or 3,000, reaching 4. And but there's probably billions and maybe trillions and multiple trillions in the entire universe of these planets. And so there's a strong, God tells us to look at his special and his general revelation. So this is part of the general revelation, nature, as one way to say it, but God's creation is the other. And so this is about approximately where we left off, and we'll see how far we get today. I've actually got another slideshow. There's a lot of details, and you know, we'll get into some of it. But finding Earth's another Earth, Earth 2.0, they like to call it. The five most Earth-like planets found so far. Actually, there's a few more than this now, and I'll tell you why we call them Earth-like in a minute. Have we found life on them? Anybody know? Have we found intelligence?
No.
No. Okay. Why? Why haven't we found it? It might be impossible. It could be there. It could be on one of them. God can certainly create bacteria, you know, on another planet if he wants. Although very few planets would be able to sustain bacteria. It would be very difficult. And let alone intelligent, spiritual life. Very, very, very difficult squared. All right, Mr. Proxmire. We'll get to that in a second. Okay, there was a few planets there, and some recent announcement on exoplanets. Oh, you all saw those people. Remember I showed the videos last time of some of these astrobiologists, these PhDs, and you know, professors at very high-ranking positions in universities, and they are just convinced that there's intelligent life throughout the universe. So here's a few of the planets we found lately. Gliese 581, that was back in 12, tops the list of habitable planets. Kepler 186f, the first Earth-sized planet in the habitable zone. We'll talk about what that is in a moment. Oh, and your vocabulary list, double-sided. If I use a word, it should be on there if it doesn't make sense. And the other side, we'll get to that in a minute, the darker side. Okay. Here's a little more on Gliese 581, the best candidate to host life beyond our solar system, according to a new ranking of potentially habitable alien worlds. These are quotes from reputable scientists. My own personal feeling is that the chances of life on this planet are 100%. Well, I have almost no doubt about it. Okay. We'll be there soon. Okay, properties of Gliese. All right, is it star like our star, like our sun? Is the planet like our planet? Let's look at some of the characteristics. More than twice as massive as Earth. Okay, they said it was in the habitable zone. Remember what that was, the water habitable zone, where water can stay liquid. It's a certain distance from the star, not too hot, not too cold, also called the Goldilocks zone. And So it is in that, but it's twice as massive as this Earth. It's a host is an M dwarf star. And if you look on your vocabulary sheet, there's a, let me grab one of those. You got one, Barry? That's okay. Okay, the main sequence. There's a sequence of stars from smallest, coolest, to largest, and usually hottest. Some are left out. They don't fit right. But M is the smallest type of star. It's often called a red dwarf. And it's pretty cold. And to be in a habitable zone around a small red star like that, it has to be very close to that star. And so problems arise. Orbital period's 30 days. Tidally locked. Anybody tell me what tidally locked means? Same face is always facing the star. It never rotates completely. One time in a, it's actually rotating once as it goes all the way around. What do you know that's real common, a common body? Our moon. Very good. The moon is tidally locked. And that's what happened when a body orbits too close to another body. No atmosphere, very likely. It's so close, the atmosphere sputters away, gets burned off. It may not exist.
That's a real big problem.
Well, besides that, let's see what else we got here. Okay, Kepler-186, we saw that a minute ago. Historic discovery of the first truly Earth-sized planet found in the habitable zone. This is the best case for a habitable planet yet. And the results are absolutely rock solid. The planet may not be rocky, but I'd bet my house on it. In any case, it's a gem. So remember Jeff Marcy, the one guy we saw in the lecture last time? He was the guy that was just, I mean, he was smiling and happy and just giddy about exoplanets and extraterrestrial intelligent life. There's Kepler-186. What an artist's rendition. As we cannot see it this well. There's no telescope that can see details like that. So that's just an artist's rendition of what it might have looked like. Yeah, clouds and water. Well, let's see. It is in the water habitable zone. Okay, properties. It's an M dwarf star again. Mm-hmm. One of those little red ones. Orbital period 130 days. Tidally locked. Habitability depends on atmosphere. Yeah. Very active star, likely stripped atmosphere, just like the other one. Yeah, Carol.
Just so we have comparison, what is our sun considered? What category?
That main sequence. Our sun is a G star. It's right in the middle of these stars. You start with the OBAF, O being the hottest, biggest ones, and on down the line all the way to through M. Earth is G, and then there's K and M, and so they get colder as you go down like that.
It's
so
important to note, obviously, they're not distributed equally. Half of the stars are M, which is why they're finding these Ms.
Yes.
G represents anywhere from 4 to 7%.
That's right, Dave. You're correct. Very few of the stars are G. And by the way, you've seen all the lectures here. The G star has to be just the right age. If it's a little older than our star, a little younger, there's a lot more solar flaring. So we happen to be in that perfect window here. So, you know. Yeah. Okay, Kepler-452b, awe-inspiring. Substantial opportunity for life to arise, should all the necessary ingredients be there. This one's a little closer. Let's see what we got here. It orbits a G star, like the sun, 5 times more massive than Earth.
Close to the sun, not like
yeah.
the sun.
Yeah, closer. There is no sun duplicate. We have not found one. We found G stars. Like Dave said, 5% of the stars are G, but that's still a few billion in our galaxy. But so 5 times more massive, what would that mean? What would that do? You think you could walk on that? Gravity would be so strong that you can only withstand about 1.5 times the Earth gravity. You wouldn't be able to walk at anything stronger than that. And so that would be like 2 or 3 times. Yeah, Helen.
If it's the other one was tidally locked, does that mean there's no day and night?
Yes. Good question. Day on one side all the time, night on the other side all the time. So a lot of these astrobiologists will say, well, wait a minute, isn't there an in-between zone on the tidally locked planets? You know, right between the light and the dark, and it's just right. Well, yeah, sort of, although a lot of them aren't perfectly tidally locked. Right. They kind of go, as they're going around, they kind of do this, so that in-between area changes constantly, and it's getting heated and melted. But worse than that is for life, you need an atmosphere for most, even bacteria. So what's going to happen to the atmosphere on a planet that's tidally locked? It's going to be really messed up. And, you know, one side's freezing, the other side's hot, and the air is just going to whip around like crazy, and you're never going to have a livable atmosphere on those. So this one's not tidally locked. And 384 days? Close. Most likely has dense H2, that's hydrogen atmosphere, and a runaway greenhouse effect. So that's the planet, of course. And like Venus. Venus has a runaway greenhouse effect. Yeah, John?
What makes them suspect that?
That would be normal. Anything in the Earth is exceptional. I think most of you know why. The Earth should have an atmosphere like 7 or 8 times more dense than Venus, which is, you know, like 200 atmospheres of pressure, Earth atmospheres. And so why doesn't the Earth have that? Anybody know? The collision, right. The moon forming collision back when the solar system was about 10% of its age. This other orbiting body that was in the same orbit as the Earth, eventually it collided with the Earth. It's a planet they call Theia. Yes?
When I hear this a number of times that we should have an atmosphere many times more dense than Venus except for the moon forming event, why doesn't Venus have an atmosphere many times what Venus has?
Well, like I said, it's about 200 times more pressure on Venus than there is on Earth. Okay. You mean why did it have a moon forming event?
Oh. Were it not for that, why doesn't Venus have a much higher pressure than it does have?
It's, for one thing, it's about 10-15% smaller than Earth.
And the other one is the closer you get to the sun, the more the sun rays blows away.
It sputters it away. The sun has an astrosphere. This pressure that comes out of the sun, it's, you know, ions and X-rays and so on. And it actually pushes those atmospheres away. So Venus is more apt to lose atmosphere than the Earth because it doesn't have a magnetic, there's no magnetism like the Earth has, which holds a lot of the Earth's atmosphere in. Okay. All right, now this is an example of the water habitable zone. And there's three different star systems. Look at the bottom one. And I'm going to try to... Over here, I'm going to use a laser on this side if you can see it. But the bottom one is our habitable, our solar system. And you'll see Earth right here. And we're right on, almost on the outer edge of the green habitable zone. That's where water stays liquid. It doesn't boil away and it doesn't freeze very much, except at the poles of planets. But, and you'll see Mars out. Earth's in here, Mars is out on the outer edge, and Venus is on the very inner edge And so in a sense, those other two planets are in our solar system's water habitable zone. I like to call it water habitable zone. And you'll find out why in a few minutes. But and then you look at this one here. This is Kepler 452. Here's the star, Kepler 452. And here's its planet, 452b. It's called B because it was the second planet found around that star. And so it's in the water habitable zone. Now, we haven't found the other planets yet, except for A, and I'm not sure where it's at. And then up here we have another typical M-class star, and it's Kepler 186. And you can see how close the water habitable zone is to that little dwarf red star. And so it's so close. It may be a cooler star, but there's a lot more radiation in that zone. So it's very difficult for life there. Yes, Dave.
One of the problems with this diagram that I have is the bottom green circle is constant. In other words, this year, next year, the year after, that circle will be the same. Those other two circles, you need to know, are averaging. Those stars are varying by 4 to 5, 6, 7. The M stars probably vary up to 30% brightness.
Yeah.
That's an average of the star's brightness over a period of time. And so it's not, that circle will get smaller and bigger. And that's what really is lacking from these diagrams that really have problems and aren't honest. Uh-huh. Is the bottom one, is again, the variation is zero. That circle will stay the same year after year. These other top two circles are dynamic and will change over time, you know, in some cases day to day, month to month, mm-hmm. year. And those are average numbers.
True. And what you're talking about is stability. Right. And our star is exceptionally stable. Compared to the other billions and billions of stars. And there are some stable M-class stars, but they're not on the level of our G star, our sun, the stability that it has. And so what Dave's talking about is if the star's heat radiation varies during the year or over the years, that means that green zone's going to move out or in. And so a star that's in the green zone, the water habitable zone, in another year may be out of it. But the Earth has remained in it since the formation, or since shortly after the formation of the solar system. So big difference. You're right, David. Most stars are very unstable.
So when you read that, just know it's an average.
Yeah. Good point. Okay. And of course, exobiologists would say this connotes that extraterrestrial life is feasible for planets of many stars, because every star has some kind of a water habitable zone, and generally there's a planet in it. So billions of stars out there. So let's see what else we got here. Okay, here's another way to look at it. You may recall this. On the left y-axis, you'll see different stars in the main sequence. The very bottom left here is here's a little M-class red star that we've been talking about. Here's a little bit bigger star, M-class, and a K, and here's a G. That's our sun. That's specifically supposed to be our sun. And you guys see that over there? Okay. All right. Yeah, the yellow one. Sorry, Steve. I'll do my best for you. And then on the x-axis is distance in astronomical units, one being how far the Earth is. Look right up here, and you'll see Earth right above one on your x-axis. And so here, the blue zone here is what was green on the other. That's the water habitable zone. And you can see, if you're close to a M-class red dwarf, the water habitable zone is much closer. And as you get up toward the sun, it's much further out. Anything inside of here would be too hot. Anything outside, where our gas and ice giants are, would be too cold. So, and guess what's inside of there? There's Mars, Earth, Venus should be in there. And here's a few other stars that we talked about. And we don't have the ones drawn in here that we talked about. But So that's just another way to look at it. Is that pretty clear? Yeah, Dave? I know, it varies from time to time.
No, besides the sun barrier, now you have to say that this also is an average, is that we have not found a single planet has an excentricity like ours. So the other thing that's unique about our solar system, everything there is all eight of our planets are almost circular orbits.
Exactly.
Now, of these 2,000 exoplanets we found, none of them have had circular orbits. They all have very elliptical. They more look
very.
Like Pluto. They look like Pluto, not like our solar system.
Now,
which means, again, that zone is an average. The planet typically is going to go on the inside of that blue zone and outside, on as it goes around the sun.
During its one cycle, Dave's right. It could a planet, you know, say like this one here, during its one cycle, may be out here part of the year and out here part of the year. And so the orbits of the planets in our solar system are so precise, so near circular. And so that's just to help you. Liquid water, origin of life, is driven by natural selection. This is something that they're claiming now, that there's actually natural selection going on at the atomic and molecular level. Yeah. So,
didn't Dean Kenyon disprove that years ago?
It's been proven and disproven, you know, and so it comes back again, though.
Meaning there's no innate direction that
right.
molecules go. Except maybe on a simple level.
Yeah. Yeah, for like an ionic bonds and molecules attract each other. But do they attract each other in an informational method? Other than in crystals, they do somewhat in a crystal. But other than for life, no. But that's what is a big issue now. Then after that, of course, Darwinian evolution would proceed and produce complex and intelligent life.
Can I ask a silly question?
Sure.
If we got hit by some planet, what did you say the name was?
It's called Theia, or Theia, yeah.
Theia, okay. And it knocked off part of our atmosphere.
Yeah, all the atmosphere was.
A lot of atmosphere, yeah. Do we have a rather circular orbit around the sun? Did it not knock us into, or was it not big enough to do so?
Well, two reasons. One, it was only about the size of Mars, maybe a little bigger, which is like 1/7 the size of Earth. And it was a very slow glancing hit. So it wasn't enough to knock the Earth out of its orbit and or slow it or speed it up too much. And so it's almost like there was design there, you know, like this planet hit the Earth and at just right speed. And then, of course, some of the Earth's mass was lost. That became the moon. And some of the colliding planet's mass was lost into the Earth. A lot of the heavier elements, they sank to the center of the Earth, the iron-type elements and radioactive elements, which, of course, then later helped us have an atmosphere because it produced a dynamo effect on the Earth. Yeah, Dave?
I asked Hugh that question 3 weeks ago, and he gave a very interesting answer that I hadn't heard before.
Okay.
One of the other things that we found with all these exoplanets and looking at stars is stars typically have absolutely no platysmals, in other words, no asteroid belts at all, or they have one huge one. It looks like a big dust ball around the planet. And what they've discovered recently is that because we have five asteroid belts, those asteroid belts have helped to conform our planets into a circular orbit.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's our unique asteroid belts is what actually creates the circular orbits. And I looked that up.
No, you're right.
Of course, was correct.
He did say that.
But I've never heard anybody ever say that until I asked this question. Because that was my question when we were finding these exoplanets, is why are these other planets not looking like ours? And I couldn't find an answer. You obviously found it. And there's just this one paper that did the models.
Oh.
That determined that found out that the five asteroid belts are what conform our planets to be circular.
Okay. You all know we have one major asteroid belt between Mars and Jupiter. And so, but there's other smaller, thinner ones, less populated. And what Dave's saying is that they all act to stabilize the orbits of all the planets in our solar system. And then there's the Oort cloud outside of that of planetesimals. And before that, the Kuiper belt, and then the Oort cloud. So they also stabilize it. It's just the right amount of everything. Yes, John?
I was thinking about the moon event. forming event is probably best described as a drifting contact with a larger body.
Yeah, that's good.
It was a slow velocity, but enough to where it imparted a lot of energy to the surface, making it molten, evaporating all the water and atmosphere and everything, and then enough momentum to continue on for another body to coalesce later that became the moon.
Okay. All right. Take a look at the back of your handout. We might need a light on one light. Can somebody drift over there? And okay, yeah, that'll do it. We've been talking about the water habitable zone, right? Too much, probably. But now Hugh Ross says, wait, there's at least eight other. Well, he was saying seven at one time. Now he's saying eight. Eight other habitable zones, at least, and probably more that we'll figure out in, you know, as time goes by. So we're going to talk about them right now. And on the back of your sheet there, a lot of it's summarized in his new book, Improbable Planet, Chapter 7. You'll see a lot of this, but I kind of summarized it for you. Let's see, water habitable zone, well, we've been talking about that. Ultraviolet, if you don't have a sheet and you need one, just raise your hand. Okay. Anybody else? Okay, here's another one. Ultraviolet habitable zone. Planets have to have the just right ultraviolet radiation levels for life. Okay, ultraviolet light does several things. And every star emits ultraviolet light. And so too much is harmful, too little is harmful, and there has to be a just right amount, and it's only at certain distances from a star that you get the just right amount of ultraviolet light. And anybody know what ultraviolet is useful for? A what? How about the ozone layer? You think it helps? Yeah, it helps make it, because when UV light hits water molecules in our atmosphere, it splits it apart, makes oxygen in single monooxygen and double in a molecule of oxygen. Well, up in the stratosphere, the single molecules form what you all heard of the ozone layer, right? Well, it stops harmful ultraviolet light from reaching us, life on Earth. You know what happens when you get too much ultraviolet light? You go to the beach, and that's mainly the less harmful ultraviolet light. There's much worse stuff that our ozone layer stops. So, and you yourself need some ultraviolet light. What's the vitamin that needs activating?
D.
What does D do? Makes you happy? It does. And it's... how about bones and what else?
Yes. Yeah,
a whole bunch of things. So vitamin D, and now lately it's really been in the news, you know, how important vitamin D is. And they're starting to make it the number one vitamin. So a little bit of sunlight a day is good for you, but not to the point of burning, because then it goes the other way, it can get harmful. And it can even get cancerous, yes. Okay, what's the another habitable zone? Now picture in your mind, you remember the green water habitable zones. Picture other zones. And to make this work, they all have to line up on top of each other, okay? You have to, if one's outside of the other, you might get bacterial life, but you're not gonna get complex life or intelligent life.
Beyond the list and even yak about it, you have to line up all these factors and then look for where you can find an incident of that. And they're not doing that.
They're not. This list that Hugh, this is personally came out of Reasons to Believe. Jeff has, Zurich has written a few of these, and Hugh, I don't know if anybody else has, but they're all in Hugh's book. Well, there.
If people were honest, they could not get up in the morning and go to work because they would know that we're alone in the universe. And so they are what I call overly optimistic in order to maintain their job.
Yeah. Well, you know.
Otherwise, if they were honest, they would all close their books. They were alone in the universe and not looking anymore.
This is a very popular issue, this whole thing about extraterrestrial life, and you are aware of that, how popular that
Hollywood.
Is. It's very Hollywood, but it makes a lot of money at the movies, and it's just people just are kind of fascinated with it, and they're willing to go further than they should, you know. And
made a lot of money on radio back in 1938.
Yes, correct.
It's a faith issue since God's not there. They have to find another substitute.
Well, they've used it, knowing that people are fascinated with it. They used it as a sort of a hook to get money, you know, from the government. And I, you know, it's personally, I'm all for exoplanet research to a degree, and it's rather expensive, but it's not nearly as expensive as some programs. But you know, it's just in man's nature to find the unknown, to look into the unknown. So I think it's good for us in some ways. But it, like everything we do, it can get corrupted. And I think that's what's happening. Okay, photosynthetic habitable zone. Photosynthesis, you're all aware of that plants do that, and then they make sugar, and which turns out to be our food. The sugar, of course, can be eaten by other animals. We can eat the other animals and so on, the ecological cycles. And so photosynthesis, as the only way we know it, there's several types of molecules on Earth that do it, but they're in a similar way. And if there's any other molecule, it has never evolved into existence on Earth. You know, we don't see anything other than photosynthesis. There are some chemosynthesis things where certain bacteria can eat like iron or uranium and get energy out of that. But it's kind of a rare thing.
Yep. And this eliminates all those red cross stars because they're all red. There's no green or blue light coming out of them.
Right.
So this has to do with the star color.
Yeah. Chlorophyll, the types we have on Earth, visible light is what works best. Not UV, not infrared, not even red. The red doesn't work very well. Green doesn't work very well. That's why lights reflect green. And so it's very limited. And so most of these planets are putting out red light. 90%, 95% of their light is red or infrared. It's not gonna be the engine that chlorophyll needs. M and K, yeah. But then you might get into the hotter stars, and they're so short-lived and hot and so reactive that nothing could live anyway. And so, but photosynthesis, as we know it, will not generate energy or not form sugar molecules with UV light. So all those stars that produce a lot of UV light, it will not work for photosynthesis. So there would have to be some other totally different molecule that we can't even begin to comprehend. So that's another zone. Oops. Ozone, habitable zone, planets with ozone. All right, we already talked about ozone to some degree, but the planet must be at just the right distance for the right amount of ozone to form. Again, if it's too close, ultraviolet light is going to do too much damage, and you're not going to get the ultraviolet light will sputter away the atmosphere too. So that's another zone. I'll try to get through these. Planetary rotation rate habitable zone. A planet has to rotate, you know, to keep correct temperatures on its surface. We talk about tidally locked things and how damaging that is. If a planet rotates too slow or too fast, that's also damaging. The Earth once was rotating at a much faster rate, up to one day and 4 hours. Well, you can imagine the tidal forces on the Earth, what the oceans would have been like, the tides. So it has to be at just the right distance for that. And again, keep picturing all these zones having to overlap, pancake each other, or it's not going to work for life. Planetary obliquity, that's the tilt of the planet. And, you know, the Earth's got the 23-degree tilt approximately, and it's great. It works really good for atmospheric mixing, temperature, agriculture for advanced civilization. If a planet's too close, it's going to get tidally locked, and it's going to lose that tilt. If it's too far away, it may be too tilted, and it won't. Yeah, it'll wobble. And so you won't get a nice, steady tilt like we have on Earth. The Earth's tilt is held in position two ways. One is the moon, and the other is the right. We're in that right habitat zone. Yes.
Does that help make the tilt because the moon, it made the moon? Did that help it tilt?
Probably at that time. Remember, initially the moon wasn't formed. It was just a lot of dust and debris going around the Earth. And it probably did.
Well, and even if it didn't tilt it, because it made the moon, all the stuff, the debris, it made the moon, it tilted.
Possibly. We don't know what the Earth was like before that, you know. Yeah, John.
In general, planets will have a random orientation of the axis, and the moon actually helps to stabilize the tilt axis so that it's within a narrow range to maintain the orientation that it has. It's normal to the orbit.
So it helps stabilize. Mm-hmm.
Right. Mars.
Yeah.
Mars has two moons, but Mars sometimes flips, you know, I mean, 90 degrees or more. And every few million years, because those moons are too small, they can't stabilize it. Okay, tidal habitable zone. We talked about tidal locking and stuff. 90% of stars have less than half of the sun's mass. So their planets must orbit so close that they become tidally locked. So it has, that zone has to be beyond the tidal locking area. Astrosphere habitable zone. This is, I mentioned it earlier, the star itself has a wind of particles and radiation that comes out from it. And a close planet, that wind, the astrosphere, will sputter away the atmosphere. So, again, another type of zone that has to overlap with all these other seven. And one last one here, this new one, Hugh mentioned it at Skeptics Forum last time. Electric field habitable zone. Kind of a odd one, but planets must be located where the star's UV won't dissociate too much water into hydrogen and oxygen, because often the oxygen will be lost into space. So that would be harmful to higher life. Yeah.
The designation of electric field habitable zone, there's not much of an electric field involvement with UV interaction with this water molecule.
Well, the ions, you know, the hydrogen and oxygen, they're that's where hence the name electric field. The astrosphere from number 8, just before that, that would influence it. So, among other things.
So it affects the dissociation of those ions.
Yeah. And then with the ions, this happens on every planet where there is water. And so if you have too much of it, then you're going to lose oxygen into space.
So the oxygen ions will tend to migrate.
Yeah. Out into space, yeah, towards the field. And so if you lose too much oxygen, you cannot have advanced life. Okay, John?
Comment and question.
Okay.
Number one, the water habitable zone. That's if the planet at any time in its history can contain any amount of water for any period of time.
It's not
It's not continuous water. You didn't mention.
Yeah, it's not continuous water necessarily.
That's correct.
Question: how well accepted are these 8 or 9 habitable zone accepted in the astral physical?
They're all based on publications, scientific publications. So Hugh is probably the first one that has summarized them in this manner. They're not talking about them. Astrophysicists and astrobiologists, they are not, they haven't gone here yet. So we have yet to see it. Good point. Yeah.
And I got the book and checked how deeply those two authors had thought about the origin of life question on Earth.
Mm-hmm.
It sounded like they thought about it for maybe 5 minutes.
Yeah.
You know, they just said, because we had water and we didn't have a primordial soup, then life must assemble in the nice clean water because it happened here. Therefore, it must happen.
Yeah. Well, I remember I earlier mentioned that some of them are postulating that chemicals and molecules actually undergo natural selection themselves to form life. They're competing with each other and forming, you know, that's one of their theories now. So,
right, but it wasn't, they're not there to compete. So
yeah.
Like, well, you had a football game with no players.
Yeah. Yeah. Now, there's also other habitable zones, like galactic habitable zones. The alignment with the center of the galaxy, you know, and how far up and down from the arms. So, you know, no one's even talking about those either, but the galaxy itself has a lot of... Yeah, John, go ahead.
I was just thinking the scientific thinking seems to be that there must be a mechanism for evolution. It's still just hidden. Must be a mechanism that's undiscovered, because otherwise there would have to be an intervention of an intelligent agent, and we wouldn't
dare
want to consider.
No,
that.
They're an alien.
Oh well, they're intelligent agents that might have sent a probe from a distant star system to
panspermia. Okay, here's SETI. That's on your list. SETI is. They're saying, search for extraterrestrial intelligence. That's their goal. And how would they do that? How do you search for extraterrestrial? I'm short of, you know, a spaceship landing out in the street here and little green people coming out of it. How does SETI do this?
Sound waves or something?
Radio waves. Yeah, those. So they're looking for broadcast. And they've got all these antennas set up, large arrays. Yeah. And hoping to see, you know, their version of I Love Lucy or something coming over the waves. And so I remember that movie we saw. Okay, let's see. So researchers have used the Allen Telescope Array. That's all these... radio telescopes set up near San Francisco there.
Allen?
Yeah, it's called Allen. A-L-L-E-N.
Like my last name.
Okay. So you're famous for something here, Steve. And so radio signals that could indicate the presence of intelligence. So far, the antennas haven't tuned in any broadcast. And there's no reason to get discouraged. Bacteria, trilobites, dinosaurs, they were here, but they weren't building radio transmitters. So, you know, you could have complex life, that's what SETI's saying, but they're not really searching for that. They want intelligent life. Okay, assessment of life in the universe is extremely complex from science. Trends in knowledge are contradictory. Still no explanation for the origin of life on Earth. That's getting harder and harder to deal with. Life on Earth is ubiquitous. That means it's everywhere and exists in extreme environments. Solar and extrasolar planets have an enormous range of conditions, environments, and configurations. Science is trying to find a reason why there could be life out there. There are definite patterns in extrasolar planetary systems, but the solar system is an outlier. What's that about? What does that mean?
Ours is
unique. Very good. And you'll see why in a minute when we get to another slide. In theology, not much consensus from theologians. No clear indication in the Bible about physical life beyond Earth. We can't deny that. Other than, you know, other realms. Problem of salvation of extraterrestrial beings. We'll talk a little more about that in a minute. So you can start thinking about that. What is the problem with that? Philosophy. No hope at all from philosophers. Let's see. Naturalism posits that humans and Earth are mediocre. The mediocre principle. But there's no explanation for life and humans from materialism. So philosophers are kind of in a bad spot, though, the ones that don't accept God. Okay, why should exoplanets and ET life and intelligence be of interest to us, Christians? Science of exoplanets has exploded. We all know that. Such a big issue now. Better telescopes, increased computing power, and better algorithms have dramatically improved our ability to detect SETI, or non-natural EM, electromagnetic radiation, broadcast. There have been huge increases in knowledge. Assumptions of reductive materialism dominate these efforts. All of the institutions that are involved view the results as forward progress that overtakes theism. So that's how it is, you know, out there in the academic world. Theism is slowly being ground away. Okay, and continued. Since the time of Galileo and Copernicus, science has continually diminished the status of humans in the universe. Well, we kind of overrated ourselves back then too. You know, we were the center, and everything revolved literally around the Earth, and so can't deny some of that. Copernican revolution removed humans from their central location. Biological evolution by means of natural selection, as Darwinism showed, that humans are just another species on Earth and are not the center of biological universe. So. Now that, we're talking evolution here, right? So is that science?
No.
Well, microevolution is. Discovery of life and intelligence on other planets will complete the demotion of humans. Earth and humans are not special in any way. Wow, that's kind of depressing. Those are statements that, you know, people have made. Okay, and continued the subject. Okay, here's something that religion and extraterrestrial life by this guy named David Weintraub. Affirmative answer to the question, does life exist anywhere in the universe beyond Earth, would raise immediate and profoundly important cosmotheological questions about our place in the universe. It would.
The question obviously is will it ever happen?
Yeah, probably not. Unless God chose to make an intelligent species somewhere else, we can't find any habitat or planet or anything that's suitable for.
We can't find one star.
We can't even find a star or a galaxy other than our own where it would be suitable for an intelligent, advanced civilization. Okay, if terrestrials exist, then this is a quote. My religion and my religious beliefs and practices might not be universal. If my religion is not universally applicable to all extraterrestrial others, perhaps my religion need not be offered to, let alone forced on, all terrestrial others. So, you know, what this person is, he's trying to say that we would have no right to witness to alien species. So, okay. Here's another paper. When SETI succeeds, the impact of high information contact, detection of extraterrestrials guarantees that the ETIs, that's intelligence, will be far older than us, says Alan Toh. I guess that's how you say his name. of Foundation of the Future. That's that little book right there. Their longevity is inconsistent with organized monotheistic religions typical of Earth. Such religions are responsible for the longest lasting warfare and destructions we have witnessed.
Yeah,
very untrue, but those are the kind of statements that we're up against.
So,
yeah.
So this is the SETI people that are saying this?
Yeah. Yes, this is one of the SETI people.
And of course, they don't acknowledge sin.
No.
Problems from wars.
No, well, here's another SETI person. She says, there may be something like a universal religion. Is that like those bumper stickers, you know, with a universal religion? Okay, that integrates the existence of intelligent life forms with a fully developed cosmology. There will be no sects, as religious, well, warfare would be the result. And this is inconsistent with longevity. Well,
this Moore's obviously shows an example of why they ignore the facts, because this is what they're hoping. They
yes.
Their faith, and so they're ignoring the facts.
They are.
More than a Christian would, because yes. The evidence shows they're not going to pick up any signals. And yet they have this great hope.
And faith. Yeah.
False faith.
Yeah.
Because it's not.
Okay, what should we do to address exoplanets? Should we take the Senator Proxmire, John approach? Remember him? Some of you are old enough, back in the 60s, was it? Or 70s? Yeah. Anyway, he was a senator, a federal senator. He gave the Golden Fleece Award to the NASA. For their SETI program. They actually funded it. Originally, SETI was funded by NASA. I don't think it is anymore. I'm pretty sure they don't get federal funds. But they get from other sources. But. And he that's his statement there, John. It's hard. You want to read it, John?
Yeah, I saw a cartoon that said something like that. They said they pointed the SETI antennas toward Washington.
There you go. Yeah, this has been expounded many times, you know. All right, it's hard enough to find intelligent life right here in Washington. So he was a bit hard on these folks, but, you know, I don't know if you'd call that the way Christians should be, but should we ignore it? No. I think you all realize now it's too important to ignore. Should we condemn it? Probably not. No, because the planets are there. The exoplanets are there. You can't deny that. That's real science. When you go beyond that,
you can debate, obviously, their life for things, you know, because their results are not matching their data.
Yeah. Okay.
Wouldn't it be fair to say, I mean, for those people that say, oh, you know, there'll be a whole other, like, universalistic religion and things like that, wouldn't it be better to tell them, like, well, not when, but if they find it, then we'll discuss it.
Yeah, they got the cart in front of the horse, as they say. Well, they're worried. They're worried that, you know, about religion, and that it will be a force if such things are found, you know. And so they're trying to, you know, close the gate before.
I've engaged people in this.
Have you?
I work in Hollywood, so this is the religion of Hollywood.
Yeah.
These are people, this is not theory, this is reality, people I talk to in Hollywood.
Yeah.
When they bring that stuff up, the response is always the question to say, show me one place where you think there would be advanced life. You're telling me that it's everywhere. We've been searching, we found all these planets, point one out, and of course they can't do it. And then I get down, just give me one star that you think advanced life could be around, and the answer is no. And what they've had to do is to redefine the word. So you didn't mention the word, so you need to mention it. We're looking for a solar twin. That honest people, astronomers, and these SETI people would know that to have advanced life, you need to find a star that is the age and the stability and the characteristics of the sun.
Mm-hmm.
So all of the stars are measured against our sun because we know that's the gold standard for life.
Right.
And of course, I've had some of them throw out stars. I go look them up, bring the evidence back to them, and say, this is not a candidate. It's too young, it's too old, it's too red, it's too blue, it's too big, it's too small. And get them to realize that we have cataloged 2.5 million stars, and out of those 2.5 million stars, we have not found one anywhere close to the sun.
Right. Okay, how should we address the subject? Engage with it. Don't be threatened by it. take advantage of the moment to engage science-minded people with the gospel. Like Dave just said, he does, and we should all be doing that. And you know, now with your little iPad and stuff, you can look up a star. You can go right to NASA and look at all the Kepler results. You know, they're in a spreadsheet. You can rearrange it any way you want, and find information right on the spot. This blue star, it's Sirius. You're saying there should be life there? No, it's too hot. It's only going to be in existence for a short time, and you can figure those things out pretty quickly now. Yeah, John.
The SETI people, why do they make such an egregious error about longevity? Because it takes about a third generation star, like our sun, mm-hmm. first before you get life, and that takes to get to a stable phase, and that, you know, that takes something like
10 billion years.
about 10 billion.
Yeah. Years. They skip all those details. You know how they are.
We're living in the fantasy land.
I think you're right, Steve.
They got up in the world, blind their minds.
Hmm.
So blinded.
They are. And they want to be. That's what's sad. But you know, we have a job to still to witness to them. It's hard for us, but we have to do it. And they may get downright hostile. But
I truly believe Satan's behind that. Mm-hmm. To disqualify the Bible and Christianity.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, John.
Also, if they properly considered all these aspects, it would be a great threat to funding. That's a very serious matter.
Yeah, for sure. Well, most of, you pick the European Space Agency or NASA. Oh, now there's China. They have their own space program. Almost every one of them, if it's not military that their space program is mostly based on, then it's search for life, you know, outside of our solar system.
But it is true that they'll have a lot of fun trying, and the fact that they have a null result does contribute to the argument for intelligent design.
Yeah. Okay. Explain why an origin of life by chance is not possible due to such issues as misaligned habitable zones. You all know about that now? The oxygen UV paradox, you've learned about that in here. Types of stars, we've spoken about that. Position in the Milky Way, and so on. And discuss how a strictly naturalistic viewpoint undermines ideals of identity. I was at a talk yesterday on this. Justice, free will, and science. So, you know, if you're a naturalistic viewpoint would be Darwinism, right? That everything evolved into existence. So there's no, it's all random chance.
Materialism,
yeah. And so that's why I've got these words in there, like your identity. What are you if you evolved from a bacteria, basically? Or you're just a sack of chemicals. So you have no true identity. Justice? Why? What? You know, it's all relative. You can imagine things there. For me, I pick like abortion comes to my mind, things like that. Free will. Talk I went to yesterday, the atheists are saying we have no free will. We have no free will. Everything we do is some kind of chance chemical reaction. Me standing here and you sitting there listening to me, I can't quite comprehend how that could be, but they're saying that it's all pure randomness. So we're here randomly doing what we're doing nonsensically. Yeah, Christy.
Right. If someone says, what if there's like another type of life that's not like that?
Very good. I was waiting for someone to ask that. I'll ask for you guys to step in too in a second. But the latest on that is that as far as carbon-based life, carbon is in normal temperatures and like liquid water zones and stuff, carbon is the best atom for life to be based on. You know, it can combine in many, many, many ways, in almost an infinite number of ways. And no other atom can do that. Nitrogen, somewhat. And so carbon's the most stable thing for life. Now, you can picture another existence, another exoplanet where there's intelligent life or advanced life. Maybe the life there, it's carbon-based, all right, but remember the thing about mirror images that we've talked about? It's called chirality. Homochirality means that they're the same mirror image. But like if you take an amino acid that we use on this planet, well, there's an opposite one. It's a mirror image of it. And it's you can't use it in life. And it's the same with the nucleic acids, you know, in the DNA. There's mirror images. And so they're backwards. And when you form one, the other one forms with it. That's just how it's designed. And so, but life can only use the right or left-sided one, depending upon which molecule it is. Well, what if on this other planet, in our galaxy, it used the opposite ones? So there you would still have DNA, you would still have amino acids and sugars, but they're all backwards. I don't know. So that's one. Let me tell you another one. Another one is nitrogen-based. If you went to Titan, you know where Titan is? You know, it's the big moon on Saturn. And it's got, remember they put that satellite, it went down into the atmosphere, and it saw lakes of liquid methane. And so here's the thing. A nitrogen compound is very stable in that sub-freezing zone. So there's one way of thinking now for the origin of life people is that it could be nitrogen based on a cold, cold planet. Maybe where, you know, metabolism goes by, instead of seconds like ours, it goes by thousands or millions of years. An organism breathes once every 1,000 years or something. And so, but its cells are made of nitrogen spheres instead of, you know, carbon lipid spheres like ours are. So that's how far their thinking is for origin of life, you know, really far out stuff. There's no proof whatsoever. Zero. Yeah, Dave?
There's no more proof. They've done a lot of research. I mean, silicon, arsenic, boron were all candidates. And all of those have been researched and looked into, and none of those have the complexity to make a cell. Carbon is the only thing.
Only one.
Both complex and stable. You need complex to make things.
Yeah.
And you need stable.
Yeah.
You know?
It's got both.
And that eliminates the carbon. So the research has been done, and those other things have all been eliminated.
Very good. Yeah. Mel?
I think the question is, what if there's a different periodic table in another?
We've actually checked it out.
Yeah.
Stars can burn, you look at the spectrum.
How can you prove there isn't another periodic table?
Because the telescopes have already looked and saw there. Hugh would tell you we already
looked. So far.
No.
We can look back to, you know, before elements even formed. The first 300,000 the universe was even 300,000 years old. Elements were it was all not ionized. What's it called? Plasma.
And multiverse.
Multiverse. That's your answer. Yeah. There you go. There has to be another universe with different laws, and everything's totally different. Yeah, John. Oh, wait a minute, you guys. You know, I only got a couple minutes. I can finish lecture one here. Let me see what's on here,
Ruth. No questions or comments.
Okay, don't be burdened with an antagonistic argument. Our goal is not to win the argument, but to show how scripture supports scientific observation. Right? And you all know 1 Peter 3:15, that's our motto here, right? I guess. Should be. But in your hearts, revere Christ as Lord. Always be prepared to give an answer to everyone who ask you to give the reason for the hope that you have. But do this with gentleness and respect. Keep studying. Praise God for the widespread fascination of his vast and awesome creation. And that's it. I finished. But I didn't do part 2. No. Okay.